Welcome to the Right Take Podcast, news, ideas, and conversations at the intersection of politics and culture, a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I will be your host, Mark Tapson. Greetings and welcome back to the Right Take Podcast. I am your host, Mark Tapson. We just passed the first 100 days of the Trump administration, and the verdict is in, or actually two verdicts, depending on which camp you're in. For MAGA Americans, Trump and crew get two thumbs up. They're rooting out government fraud, corruption, and waste. They've closed the border and are deporting the worst of the worst illegal aliens. They're pressuring higher education to shut down anti-Semitism on campus. They're eliminating the racist DEI programs and policies that were strangling merit and stoking racial resentment. They're defending women's sports and spaces from the misogynistic threat of trans activism. They're prioritizing lethality over equity in the military. They're helping de-escalate the risk of World War III by negotiating an end to the Ukraine war instead of pushing headlong toward it like the Democrats and establishment Republicans want. Despite some hiccups and roadblocks along the way, Trump and company are making America great again. For the progressive resistance, Trump is Mussolini 2.0, worse than Hitler, and the Antichrist. And his presidency is destroying democracy and laying the groundwork for a dictatorship in which the mainstream media, liberal judges, drag queens, radical academics, people with multiple pronouns, legal immigrants, and people of color are all being rounded up and deported or just plain disappeared. So in other words, reactions are mixed. Looking back on it, though, the fact that Trump is actually in the White House carrying out his agenda after having won the election in a landslide despite all the odds against him last year, it's nothing short of miraculous. And in fact, my guest today has written a very entertaining book about that process, about what could arguably be called the greatest comeback in American presidential politics. What a wild ride. Well, we're going to hear about that from a political pundit who drew some keen observations from it all, and I'm really looking forward to talking with him. So stay with us here at the intersection of politics and culture, because you don't want to miss this interview. And don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take so you don't miss any of the other important conversations we're having here. And remember, if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Don't touch that dial. My guest today at the intersection of politics and culture is a very recognizable Fox News personality, although you see him all over the media. He's also the author of two bestsellers with great titles, by the way. Come On, Man, The Truth About Joe Biden's Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Presidency, and Progressively Worse, Why Today's Democrats Ain't Your Daddy's Donkeys. He's got a third bestseller in the making that's just out about the presidential campaign of Donald Trump, appropriately titled The Greatest Comeback Ever. Inside Trump's Big Beautiful Campaign. Joe Concha, welcome to the Right Take Podcast.
Well, thanks for having me. This is awesome. How are you?
It is awesome. I'm good, thank you. Before we get started, I want to mention real quickly that for any listeners in the Southern California area, Joe's going to be speaking as the guest of honor at a David Horowitz Freedom Center luncheon event this Wednesday the 7th. That's tomorrow as you hear this. I'll give you more details about it later, but I urge you to make it if you can. I've seen Joe speak in person, and believe me, if you're in the neighborhood, you do not want to miss it. Joe, I'm sorry I'm going to be missing it myself because I now live in Texas, but I know that it's going to be a blast.
You made the right move, my man. I mean, how much money are you saving living in Texas as opposed to California?
The place that I got here and the property, it would cost millions, literally, in California. It's insane.
Trust me, I live in Jersey, and I tease myself sometimes looking at homes like suburban, like San Antonio area, for example, or Corpus Christi, or, you know, outside of Nashville, and what I can get in places like that, as opposed to being outside of New York City. Oh, it's just, I'm a masochist because I torture myself by looking at those properties. It's horrible.
I hear you. Joe, as my listeners and guests will confirm, I read every book that my guests come on to discuss, and I've read this one, and it's a great read. It's a lot of fun. I could hear it in your voice in my head. And it's a very interesting recap of Donald Trump's incredible, miraculous election victory against all odds. In your experience in politics, have you ever seen anything like Trump's comeback?
Well, let's see. We had the Kentucky Derby this weekend, right? So let's compare it to Secretariat back in 1973, you know, at the Belmont winning by, what was it, 27, 28 lengths. I mean, no, nothing even close to this. I mean, and really in almost anything, right? You had Red Sox over the Yankees, 2004. You want to say Revolutionary War, great comeback. Yes, you know, that's a war. It's a little different. But as far as a human being coming back from what he did, if you remember where we were a year, 2 years ago, 94 felony charges, civil cases against him. We had a hostile media, obviously, and even his own party was questioning, well, you know, is this the right guy? Should we go to a younger, better version of Trump, like a Ron DeSantis? Should we turn to a more agreeable Nikki Haley, perhaps, as far as, you know, reaching out to the female vote and trying to bring back those suburban women? But in the end, you know, I remember that line from Rocky. It was like Rocky VI, like we were six in at that point. And Rocky is trying to explain to his son why he wants to go back into boxing. And he says, you know, life isn't all sunshine and rainbows. You're going to get hit. The question is, how hard you get hit and how do you get up and how do you keep moving forward? And Trump was just like resilient in terms of moving forward, getting through all those cases. Obviously, some were dismissed and just going towards the nomination. He steamrolls DeSantis, steamrolls Nikki Haley. And then in the general, Joe Biden, obviously that debate, June 27th, Georgia Tech, Atlanta, his brain turns to applesauce. Actually, I shouldn't say it turned at that night, like literally it happened years ago, but finally everybody saw it. And then Kamala Harris, Soviet style, is installed. And then the media again is trying to get her over the top. And the fact that he just got through all of that, survived assassination attempts, even two of them, the fact that he won the popular vote, every swing state, Republicans take back the Senate, they hold the House, a clean sweep. I mean, this has to be the greatest comeback of all time. And that's why I wrote about it, because I felt like we were witnessing history.
Absolutely. Well, during the campaign, the Democrats threw everything at Trump, but the kitchen sink, maybe even that too.
I think that too,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, and yet every single tactic only seemed to backfire. And the more desperate and frustrated that they became, the bigger the backfire, and the more comfortable and confident Trump seemed. Can you talk, for example, about, let's pick just the media bias, the blatant media bias, and how that failed to shut down either Trump or Vance?
Right. Well, we remember, and it's a great question, when Joe Biden was still in the race and he was wandering off during the G7 during photo ops. And even for years, he'd do this weird thing when he was done with a speech and he would shake hands with the air. And I'm like, is he joking? But then it happened too much where I'm like, I think, no, that's, he thinks maybe an apparition is there or something. Then he wouldn't know how to get off the stage despite doing speeches for 50 years. Then he would have conversations like that kid from The Sixth Sense. You know, he could see dead people. He would literally be like, I was speaking with François Mitterrand a couple of days ago, and he said how happy he was I won the election. You're like, wait, Mitterrand died in 1996. Like, you know, I could go on and on. Can't remember the names of his cabinet members. Needs a cheat sheet whenever the rare times he took questions from reporters. So, you know, you see all these things, and yet the media was telling us that no, actually, those are cheap fake videos. This is Republicans pouncing on Biden's age to make Trump look better, but you know, he's as sharp as a tack. He's like a combination of Stephen Hawking mentally and Saquon Barkley physically, right? Literally, we were told this by the White House press secretary. So obviously, that was BS, and then the public didn't buy it one bit. And then we saw it with Kamala Harris when she was installed as the candidate. I have the stat in the book, and I think you probably remember it. The first 100 stories that ABC News did on Kamala Harris, stories, not like opinions, stories, like news stories, all 100 were deemed positive by the Media Research Center. I mean, even Baghdad Bob would be like, you guys are laying it on a little thick, don't you think? Even I wouldn't go that far. So, yeah, here's the thing. When you don't trust the media, when the media has the trust level of like gas station sushi, right? Like, do I really want to eat that? Like, the same thing with the media. The message falls flat and it almost has a boomerang effect at this point. I'll share this with you. During the 2016 election, right before the election, I was writing for The Hill at the time. I was a media reporter. And we did this tally of all the major newspapers around the country, 59 of them. And we found that 57 of 59 newspapers endorsed Hillary Clinton. And what did that get her? It got her a set of steak knives and a concession speech. In other words, 57 of 59 people are like, yeah, screw you. I'm going to go the other way on this. And that told me right then and there that the media, it's not like we had growing up, you know, like, you know, Jennings and Brokaw, and before that, you know, Cronkite and Mudd and Brinkley, like those days are done. And whatever we hear from the media right now, we kind of shake our head and be like, I'm not sure if I believe you, especially when the attacks are as over the top as they were with Trump. And again, he overcame that. And here he is as the 47th president.
And what about the debates? Let's talk about the debates, the Trump-Kamala debate, and of course the Vance walls debate. Despite the best efforts of the media to tip the scales in favor of the Democrats, what do you think those debates reveal to the voters about the candidates?
Fixed fight, right? WWE. I mean, and the candidates for that are fixed fight in terms of the debate moderators. In terms of ABC, that's run by Dana Walden, who is best friends with Kamala Harris. I'm not exaggerating on that. She literally set Kamala up with Doug Emhoff. They were neighbors in Brentwood. Walden contributed to Kamala for years, and now she's running the news division that's going to hold the only debate between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. I mean, that is just, you know, 31 flavors of insanity. And then CBS, same thing, obviously, with the vice presidential debate, and Margaret Brennan and Nora O'Donnell were just, you know, profoundly horrible during that, fact-checking J.D. Vance. He fact-checks them back, and they shut off his mic because he was making such good points. It was, again, so obvious to the American people what was going on. But what it said about the candidates, Kamala Harris in that debate, afterwards, almost every member of the media saying that, oh, boy, she won going away. She's going to win this election now. So I'm on with Bill Hemmer and Dana Perino the next day in America's Newsroom, and they say, so, you know, what do you think? And I said, I don't think Kamala made the sale. I think it was incumbent on her to tell people exactly what her positions are, because obviously she flipped on everything. And I didn't hear anything in terms of the economy, in terms of how she's going to fix inflation and grow the economy. She talked about giving $25,000 tax credits to first-time homeowners. Well, that's nice, but that applies to like 0.04% of the population. Like, that's not a solution. That's throwing money at a problem. And I said, you know, I didn't hear anything in terms of how she's going to solve the border. I don't know how she's going to end the war in Ukraine. I just went right down the list. And they said, well, what about Trump? You know, he didn't have his best night. I said, well, maybe he didn't, but it wasn't incumbent upon him to sell, because we already know what we're getting. We already know what we had, and we already know what we're going to get. So Kamala didn't win that debate. And sure enough, when people thought that her numbers were going to skyrocket, they started to go down from that point, which is remarkable to me. And then the vice presidential debate, you have goofy Tim Walz calling J.D. Vance weird, right? Weird, the guy who came from a broken home and put himself in the Marines and then went to Yale and graduated law school and then became a movie maker, and, you know, obviously best-selling book, the movie, the senator, then a vice presidential candidate. Now, that's not weird. That is one of the best success stories I've ever heard. And Walz looked like a deer in the headlights. I hate using the term because it's overused, but it's true. He looked like, you're like, that guy can't be a heartbeat away from the presidency. And JD was intelligent, smooth, as good, and affable, right? Like, even Walz like almost liked him on some level because he thought he'd get into a fight. And instead, it was just like a nice little debate. So those two debates, I think, were big for different reasons, where Kamala didn't make the sale and Tim Walz exposed himself to be the worst pick in vice presidential history, while J.D. Vance looked like a guy who could be president one day. And I think those were big, big nights in the campaign.
Yeah, you pointed out in the book that vice presidential debates rarely move the needle. But this Vance-Walz debate was the exception. I think Vance came out of it just looking like incredible presidential material. And Walz, meanwhile, as you point out, he came across as the real weirdo. You mentioned that Kamala's selection of Walz was a critical misstep for her campaign. How did he contribute to what you call the Democrats' utter collapse?
Oh boy! Well, the miscalculation obviously was, here you have Kamala Harris has to win Pennsylvania. That is a Nate Silver had it at whoever wins Pennsylvania has a 98% chance of winning the election, okay? As Pennsylvania goes, the whole election goes. And she has a governor there, a Democrat, in a purple state, who is currently, or not currently, at the time, was polling at 62% approval, okay? So even Republicans may like him, independents like him, that's fine. And she could choose Josh Shapiro, and she said, no, I don't think I want to upset the anti-Semitic wing of the party. Seriously, right? And, oh, we got these voters in Dearborn, Michigan. They're all Muslim. They're going to hate the fact if I choose a Jew. I hate to put it that way, but that's why Shapiro wasn't chosen, because it wasn't because of his record. It wasn't because of his oratory skills. And then instead of going with somebody else, like Mark Kelly in Arizona, somebody who's not really going to hurt you per se, she picks this guy, the governor of Minnesota, who let Minneapolis burn to the ground in 2020. I have a third grader in elementary school, would put a tampon machine in my kid's bathroom if he could here in New Jersey, right? Said he was in Tiananmen Square during that massacre. Wasn't in it, but was in Hong Kong. And wait, no, he's back in a cornfield in Nebraska. He said that he carried weapons of war when he ditched his own National Guard unit. There were 1,000 holes you could poke in his stories. No one did the proper vetting here. And that was critical because, as we just talked about, Tim Walz cannot be seen as president of the United States if something were to happen to Kamala Harris. And plus, he just came across as incompetent. So overall, there was an answer to your question here somewhere, but I got lost in thought. What was the question again? Sorry.
No, you nailed it. It's just about how Walz was part of the collapse of her campaign and what a terrible choice it was. I thought it was also interesting that the Democrats tried to push Walz and Kamala's husband, Doug Emhoff, as icons of 21st century masculinity. How well did that work out for the party?
Not too good, right? I mean, it's this, we're going to take this entity, right? In this case, this couple. And Doug Emhoff is as beta male as, like, you know, Prince Harry. Like, it's just not, he's like a Pete Buttigieg, but, you know, less hair. You can't. And same thing with Tim Walz, for that matter. They're like, well, you know, this is a man's man who could talk to white males, particularly in the Midwest. He's a Midwest guy. Here he's going to change this oil filter and show you how to do it. Except when he changes the oil filter, you see literally the oil filter that he changed was completely fine. Like, you know, he did not load a shotgun. That's Tim Walz. And Doug Emhoff, I mean, just when you heard him during interviews, the first thing you don't think of is MacGyver. You know, you're thinking something else, but no, it just wasn't really working. And obviously, then they tried to make Kamala Harris into the joy candidate, right? Into this really cool girl who worked at McDonald's once and can relate to the working man and woman. No, she is an elitist San Francisco liberal who in 2019 supported sex changes for those here illegally while in prison. That's who she was. And ultimately, thanks to social media, not our regular media, but social media, like the Paul Revere's out there, made sure that her record got out there and people knew it.
In addition to detailing all these things, your book slams Harris's disastrous campaign strategy, like her decision to avoid Joe Rogan's podcast. Every bad choice she made just underscored her disconnect from the voters, didn't it?
Oh, God. I mean, there are several bad decisions, but from a media perspective, that was the worst. And her, it's not so much Kamala was making the decisions. It was Steph Cutter. It was Dan Plouffe. It was Jen O'Malley. These are veterans of the Obama 2012 campaign, which people are like, wow, it was a masterful campaign. She's in good hands. They ran a 2012 campaign is the problem when podcasts weren't a thing. So when it was time to go on Joe Rogan, they were petrified to put her in front of anybody without a teleprompter for 3 minutes, let alone for 3 hours, because when she speaks outside of a teleprompter, she becomes a human Chernobyl. So you're like, okay, we got to get to the Rogan audience, right? But, you know, we can't expose her for too long. So they made all these ground rules. Like, okay, Joe Rogan, we're not going to you in Austin, Texas. You're coming to us, which he ain't going to do. He's never done that for anybody. Didn't do it for Trump, didn't do it for J.D. Vance. I'll go down the line. And then they said, we're not going 3 hours. We're only going an hour. And oh, by the way, we want a preview of what topics you want to talk about, which that's not Joe Rogan, because Joe just kind of freewheels, right? He's not writing down like, I will ask this as my third question. No. And that's what makes it such a compelling listen, because it just feels like a guy who is, I don't say winging it, but he has a plan, I'm sure, going into a certain extent, but it's not scripted in any way. So she turns him down, but then she turned down the Al Smith dinner, which, oh, you gotta have the Catholic vote. And oh, by the way, it's not like you had to go to Tuscaloosa, you know, Birmingham, Alabama. You were going to Manhattan, which is like the most blue place in the world. And her people say, don't go. It's going to humanize Trump for starters. They knew she wasn't good at comedy. Again, outside of a teleprompter, she's going to have problems. And then she sends a video instead with Molly Shannon, who was relevant back during the Clinton years. I mean, like, not Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton. And it's this video that got booed. It was booed in the hall. And meanwhile, Trump kills it. He's the ultimate roaster. Told some great jokes that night. He said, you know, this is the first time that I've been in Manhattan in some time where I haven't been served a subpoena. See, that's funny.
Yes. Right? And self-deprecating, too.
And self-deprecating, exactly. And at one point, they said, he even mentions the self-deprecating part. He goes, you know, they told me I have to say something self-deprecating tonight, so here it goes. He pauses. He goes, nope, nothing coming to mind. I mean, that's funny. But here's the best line. This is what I love the most. He said, you know, Democrats, they keep trying to convince me that there's more than two genders, and I keep saying no. That was until I met Tim Walz. See, that's funny. Right? So he kills it that night. And the clips are everywhere. And all you hear about how is Kamala avoided it. And I'm like, boy, he's definitely winning this now, because she looks afraid and he looks confident. And the candidate that's having fun is the one that you know is winning. And you can tell by the Al Smith dinner at that point, Trump's numbers internally told him that he was winning.
Yeah, I love how you contrasted Kamala, who was supposedly running on what they actually call the politics of joy, but who, despite her manic cackling, doesn't seem or didn't seem to be having any fun at all. While Trump, as you just pointed out, he just naturally presented himself as fun and relatable and having a sense of humor.
Right. When do you have fun? Like when you do this podcast, right? It's fun for you. This is a labor of love. When I go on Fox or when I do interviews like this, it's supposedly work, but it's like what Dick Vitale used to say. He'd be like, I can't believe they're paying me millions to do college basketball, baby. You know, it's true. The same thing with me talking about this stuff. Trump being on the, you know, on the stump, doing rallies, doing interviews, that's fun for him. That is not fun for her. She was a profoundly horrible candidate in 2019. And I say 2019 because she never got to 2020. Because she doesn't like to campaign. She really doesn't like to work all that much, according to her former aides in the White House, as far as being vice president. And then if the interviews, that is, you know, that is toxic. That is her kryptonite. So to do these things, while they tried to make it look like she really liked to do it, to your point, you could tell that that was the last place she wanted to be. But she wanted to be president. She just didn't want to have to go through the effort of being president.
On a more serious note, what about the assassination attempts on Trump? Because these were very pivotal moments in his campaign. What about those?
Oh, boy. Well, yeah, I mean, those were during this was where we got to the boy, I still have a lot of questions part. All right. As far as how these things nearly got pulled off. I mean, for example, it's July 13th. I'm about to go on Fox to the big weekend show. And I'm taking my usual notes. I took a lot of notes for this book, so I always had like my phone open and ready to go. And I'm listening to see if he'll say anything different, because 2 days before that, Joe Biden had said, it's time to put Trump in a bullseye. And I'm, oh boy, I mean, really? Now, I'm not saying the shooter heard that and said, you're right, I'm going to go kill Trump now. But the rhetoric was just out of control at that point. And that was one big example. And, you know, you heard the pop, pop, pop. You saw Trump like grab at his ear like he just got stung by something. And then you see him go down. And you're like, oh my God, what's happening? And for a good minute, the Secret Service is on top of him. You don't know what's happening. And then in that moment, and I asked him about this. I said, all right, you're on the ground. You know you're hit. You have blood on your face. I said, my instinct personally, and this isn't self-deprecating, I know myself. I would be like, all right, stay down, keep them on top of you, the Secret Service, get me to a stretcher or something, get me in the first car and I'm out of here, right? His first thought was, I know my family is watching. This is exactly what he said to me. He goes, you know, I got up because I thought it wouldn't be good if I stayed down or if I just got out of there without acknowledging that I was good. And he said, so that's why I said fight, 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 because I wanted my youngest son to know who was watching. My wife was watching. My family was watching. The country was watching. And I wanted them to know that, A, I was okay, and B, nothing was going to stop this movement and to keep moving forward, fight, fight, fight. And I'm like, wow. I mean, you got to be – I would not think that way. And then he said – but he did reveal there was a stretcher on the stage, which was the first time I had heard that. And he said, they told me like, all right, get on the stretcher. He said, no way in hell am I getting on that. Right. Cause again, he didn't want to look weak. So that was a moment where I turned to Chaffetz and I said, after I knew he was okay, of course, I go, I think he just won the election. Like, and a lot of people have revealed to me since that, yeah, I said the same thing. The second assassination attempt, I was at Trump International just last week for a speech, and that's where it took place, West Palm Beach. And I went, you know, I had some time to kill before the speech. So I walked near the sixth hole where the sniper's nest was for Ryan Ruth, right? And remember, Ruth had said in social media posts that democracy must be saved and Donald Trump must be stopped. And that sounds exactly like something that Chuck Schumer was saying, that Hakeem Jeffries was saying, that Kamala Harris was saying, that Tim Walz was saying, right? So he was mimicking exactly what Democrats were telling him. And I'm not saying they're saying stop him by killing him, but that's how enough crackpots are going to take it, like Orion Ruth, right? So all that said, I looked at where that sniper's nest was, and if anybody walked the perimeter, even casually, they would have spotted this guy, all right? And the fact that no one walked the perimeter for 12 hours, he's there just waiting. I mean, there are a lot of questions still. Why did somebody send Trump on that stage in Butler on July 13th when they knew there was an active threat? How could you possibly do that? You say, Mr. President, you're staying here until we know where the threat is and until it's contained. And somebody decided to send him out there anyway, and no one's been fired. That's what's remarkable to me, and we asked those questions in the book.
What about those security lapses? Do you think they were part of the broader opposition to Trump's candidacy?
I don't know. Yeah, see, that's where I go into the I don't know stage, and I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but at some point, there's incompetence, and then there's intent. And I'm right on that line, you know, because why did Jill Biden, the first lady, also was doing a speech in Pittsburgh that day, not far from Butler, about 35 minutes south. And she had more assets and more resources, and she had the A team while Trump had the B team. Who's under threat more, do you think, right? Jill Biden in a hall somewhere. So once you're inside, the chances of you being taken out are considerably down. And meanwhile, Trump's security apparatus allows a 20-year-old kid to outflank the Secret Service and law enforcement. He hides a high-powered rifle the day before, right near that building where he got on top of, and then no one thought to secure the one building that had line of sight to that stage. That is utterly remarkable to me. I mean, you can't be that incompetent. I've never been in the Secret Service. I'm not going to act like I'm an expert in this, but, you know, I know basic geometry, and at that point, that's the one place you had to secure, and they didn't do it, and I just want to know why.
Joe, amid all of the media debacles and the lopsided debates and the lawfare and the assassination attempts, at what point do you think it became obvious that Trump would win? Was it the first assassination attempt?
I said, I think he just won the election. I said that then. I think I still wasn't quite sure because there were so many variables out there, like whether Biden would be the opponent, for example. I knew 100%. If you look at the back of the book, you'll see exactly when I said this with the predictions on the back, and I know you read it. The Teamsters had two polls that came out, internal polls, and they're the largest union in the country, especially big in Pennsylvania and Michigan. And they found in the first poll, when Joe Biden was the candidate before the debate, that Biden was favored by 10 points among the rank and file, not favored, but approved, or 10% more would vote for him than 10 points higher than Donald Trump when Biden was in it, because Biden's always portrayed himself as very pro-union, so you could kind of understand that to a certain extent. Then Kamala Harris is installed as the candidate. They do another poll, rank and file, Donald Trump by 30 over Kamala. I'm like, all right, that's it. It's over. If she can't get the union vote, not just Teamsters, United Auto Workers, U.S. Steel, restaurant unions, she can't get them, and she's losing black votes where she has to run up the score in Atlanta, Pennsylvania, Detroit. If she can't secure enough of the Latino vote, and Trump was like even with her at that point, I'm thinking, where exactly do the votes come, especially in swing states, that puts her over the top? And that's when I went on Hannity. It was October 2024, and I said, and I don't have the book in front of me, but I'm going to paraphrase myself, Trump wins this, and he wins quite easily. Save the tape. Play it back if I'm wrong. This is how this is going to end. Exactly what I said on national television. Even Sean was like, wow, you're the most bullish I've seen. I go, Sean, the numbers, and I don't see where the votes come from for her. And sure enough, for once I was right. I had the Chiefs beating the Eagles in the Super Bowl this year. Very wrong. I had this Trump winning the election, perhaps a little more important, got that one right.
You yourself interviewed Trump in October 2024, and you talk about that in what I think is the last chapter of the book. What was that like? And also, why, with all the odds against him in a fixed fight, as you noted earlier, why did he keep moving forward instead of just throwing in the towel, which would have been the easiest thing to do?
Exactly what I asked him. Yeah. So I interviewed him after the election. It was December of 2024, after he won, of course. And I did. That was my first question. I go, with everything thrown at you, you know, you got a nice life. Why would you jump back into a fight where it might be fixed? Like, it might be something that no matter what you do, what you say, you run the perfect campaign, and somehow still, because maybe you're put in jail, maybe you're shot at, maybe the media just will not give you even one fair shake, and you're always portrayed as, you know, a fascist. Why jump back into that when you're not going into an even fight? He said, Joe, quite simply, because these people are crazy, talking about Democrats, and we have a country to save, and it's more than about me. It's about saving the country from the past that Democrats want to bring them down. And I feel like I'm best equipped to do that. But more importantly, I have a movement behind me that will make sure that I get there. I'm like, all right, that's a good answer. I'm like, we're off and running. And then from there, we talked about the first assassination attempt, which we talked about earlier. And then I allow my son, he wasn't there, he was at school, but I asked Liam, he's 9 years old. I said, so Liam, what should I ask the president? He said, well, how's he going to bring down the cost of cheeseburgers? Because my son, despite being a rail, loves cheeseburgers, right? And I asked the president that, and I never really heard him like laugh out loud before. You know, I've seen him smile and I see him grin, like a laugh. I didn't hear that. It wasn't a bellyache kind of thing, but I heard a laugh for the first time. I found that interesting. And he said, and then he gave me an answer I didn't expect. He goes, well, it's all about energy. I mean, that's the whole ball game. And if we get the cost of energy down by drill, baby, drill, domestic drilling, fossil fuels, fracking, the whole thing, if we get the cost of energy down, then the trucks to get to the restaurants and the supermarkets don't have to pay as much in terms of gas. Then the restaurants themselves don't have to pay as much as energy. And then the theory is that they pass those savings on to the customer, and then your son can get more cheeseburgers. That makes sense. So it was such a compelling interview because I'm not an economist, but I'm like, I never looked at it that way. But yeah, so that's what makes the interview fun, because you're going to hear some things that you never heard before.
That must have been awesome.
Yeah.
Joe, we just passed Trump's first 100 days. I know that's still kind of early, but what's your verdict on him and his administration so far?
I look at numbers primarily when I try to form an opinion, because they tend to behave, and you're not, you know, they don't have feelings. So I see the inflation rate at just 2.4%, came down last month. So that's good. It's going in the right direction. I see 99% drop in border crossings without building one more inch of the wall. I find that to be the most remarkable accomplishment of any first 100 days, considering that no legislation has actually been passed to try to fix this problem. But it turns out you need a new rhetoric. You need a few more thousand National Guard troops at the border, and you just need the right message to these people. Don't come. It's not going to go well for you, right? So that's remarkable to me. I see unemployment around 4%. That's about as low as you can get, basically. So I see people are working. I see when we see unemployment reports like that jobs report we saw last week, 177,000 jobs added, that a big, big chunk of those jobs are not government jobs like they were under Biden, but they're private sector jobs, particularly manufacturing. These are all good things. So when I look at the border, when I look at the progress in terms of bringing Russia and Ukraine to the table, I know we're not there yet. When I see that, again, with Israel and Gaza, completely as Israel's back, as opposed to Biden and Harris kind of hemming and hawing on that back and forth because they had an election to win. And then I see the economic numbers. I understand that the tariff war is a big, big deal, and I'll get to that in a second. But right now, out of the gate, I would give him an A. And Democrats have stopped him at every turn. I mean, he wants to pass a law outlawing men playing as women in sports, and Democrats all vote against it. Well, okay, there's a campaign ad right there, right? He wants to pass a law saying you need voter ID to vote. You know, like you want to buy a bottle of liquor, well, all right, you need ID. You want to get in a plane, you need an ID. You want to vote? Democrats are like, ah, don't worry about it, you don't need it. Again, another 80-20 issue that they're on the wrong side on. So he's put Democrats in a bad position. The economy, I think, is going in the right direction. The next 100 days are imperative to his success. If he can get zero for zero tariffs with places like the EU and Japan and India, and he can bring them together as a coalition, then go to China and say, okay, we're all playing ball here. You come on board as well. Let's all make this better for us. And he's able to get a better deal out of China. And then he's able to pass that big, beautiful bill in the House and Senate that primarily has some big tax cuts in it. I think that's rocket fuel for the economy. And then from there, Democrats have no answers, because to this point in the first 100 days, we have not heard solutions. It's only been Festivus, an airing of grievances signifying nothing, right? There's no message. It's just save democracy. It's like, wait, you installed a candidate. You not really aren't about democracy, are you? So yeah, Democrats will be in big trouble, but the next 100 days are key. If that bill fails, somehow it goes sideways, that's a big problem. And if the tariff war begins to go sideways where Trump has to cave and then nothing is really accomplished, then Democrats have a very good chance in the midterms in 2026, because it's all about the economy, stupid.
After this second Trump term and then 8 years of J.D. Vance as president, do you think we will have made a lot of progress toward making America great again?
Well, you know, then you got to remember Barron Trump, you know, in 44. That's going to be a big, big candidacy. Well, yeah, look, I mean, again, if Trump has a successful term here, then J.D. Vance is going to be the nominee. I mean, I'm not even going to play around with anybody else getting it. I mean, the MAGA will go, you know, hand in glove along with him. And J.D. is an excellent candidate, as we talked about. Then from there, again, you find me who's going to run for the Democrats. If I got to hear about Stephen A. Smith and AOC one more time, I mean, if they run people like that, they're going to lose 51 states, which is mathematically impossible, but they'll find a way. America will be made great again if you have, let's see, it'll be, I guess, like the Reagan-Bush years, like 12 straight years of Republican rule. Then Democrats would have to come back to the center. And I don't think they're capable of doing that. I think they're permanently on the left at this point. Social media keeps them there. MSNBC, CNN, New York Times keep them there. They don't know better. And if anybody, let's put it this way, and I'll leave it here because I know you got to go. Michael Bloomberg was an excellent mayor of New York, right? He's been a Republican, he's been an independent, he's been a Democrat. I lived in New York during his three terms. He ran it like a business. It was as safe as anywhere in the country, quite frankly. And when he ran in 2020, I would entertain voting for him. I really would. I'm like, I said, I think he's quite good. And Well, not voting for him. In other words, I would see him as the nominee. Like, if he went against Trump, then obviously Trump would be my choice. But I saw Bloomberg as the nominee. And he didn't survive even a couple of weeks because, oh my God, we can't have Michael Bloomberg in here. He makes too much sense. And they wrote him out of town. So the next time I hear, like, well, a moderate could come and save the party, I don't think that person will survive, because the loud and energetic side of the party is the AOC wing. And ultimately, I think she'll be the nominee. And again, that will not go well for them at all.
I completely agree. Joe, where should people go on the internet to keep up with you and your work?
Oh, thank you. So it's at Joe Concha TV on the Twitter. And otherwise, I'm a senior writer for the Washington Examiner. So that's WashingtonExaminer.com, or we have an app for that, of course. And then otherwise, you could catch me on Fox News. Just tune in on any given hour, and you got about a 50-50 chance of me seeing me there because I have a home studio, so I could join a lot when other people can't because they'd have to commute a long way. They don't want to sit in traffic. I just walk downstairs, and boom, I pop on, and there you go. So it's a nice little convenient thing. I go in the studio also, don't get me wrong. But yeah, so that's basically the places you can find me. And I really appreciate you having me in the endorsements. And this is awesome. Thank you so much.
Oh, good to know. Joe, thanks for coming on the Right Take podcast. Keep fighting the good fight.
Mark, you're the man. Thanks so much, man.
Listeners, make sure you get a copy of The Greatest Comeback Ever. It's a very entertaining and interesting page turner. And if you're in the SoCal area, try to make this luncheon event hosted by the Freedom Center. The details can be found at frontpagemag.com under the calendar of events. And thank you for joining us. Don't forget to subscribe to The Right Take so you don't miss any of the important conversations we're having here. And remember, if you like what you hear, please leave that positive review. Be seeing you. The Right Take with Mark Tapson is a project of the David Horowitz Freedom Center and Front Page Magazine. Unauthorized reproduction of this podcast without express written consent is prohibited.